This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is The Bigger Picture with me, Lee Chui Lin. Today, I have with us Professor Sharon Britnell. She's speaking to us from Alberta, Canada. So I have her over the phone, obviously. And we are talking about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. Professor Sharon Britnell is the president of the World Federation of Occupational Therapists. Welcome to the show, Professor Britnell.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
So the last time we spoke, you mentioned that you've done some work in this area. Could you tell us a bit more about the research you've done in fetal alcohol spectrum disorder?
Well, my particular research has looked at offenders or that were already incarcerated. There is a viewpoint, and there is some data to say there's a disproportionate number of people, primarily men, but there are women who are in jail who are high recidivists. That is, they are in and out frequently. And the thinking was that these individuals may very well have fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, or they may be people who are mentally ill. And so my research was to look at a particular setting in Alberta and to see from a selection of individuals how many of them actually did have FASD, and then to put into place a program that was to support their discharge and transition to the community. So we had 49 males.
Is it important to have to draw that distinction between FASD and having a mental illness?
From a management perspective, yes, because there are some very distinguishing characteristics in both of the spectrum disorders and under the psychiatric umbrella. And so in a medical model, of course, you want to know what you're dealing with, because once you identify the disorder, it gives you insight into what kinds of interventions and or treatment that might very well be available. And in many systems, you, in order to get services, you have to have a diagnosis or a label. So for those reasons, it's very important. From a management perspective, well, it's probably not as important to understand the etiology or the beginnings of the disorder, because fetal alcohol spectrum disorders are brain impairments. So they're very much an organic disorder, as we understand it, with changes to brain structure. And of course, now as we understand psychiatric disorders more with the research in neurosciences, we know also that psychiatric disorders have elements of changes in brain chemistry and circuitry. So for accessing services and trying to be more effective in what we do, yes.
What can you tell us about the disorder itself? I mean, you know, it's I suppose common knowledge now that pregnant women should not be drinking alcohol, but I suppose there's still not that much understanding of exactly how that consumption of alcohol could affect the fetus or the baby.
Well, I think first of all, it's in Canada, particularly in my province, as you said, Alberta, they have been conscious of the major impact and costs associated with this disorder on the healthcare system, on the social system, on families. It's a very broad-based impact. And when we consider all those things, we are really recognizing that this is much a broader issue than just women in pregnancy and drinking. But having said what I've said, there is still a very high rate. FASD is responsible for a significant proportion, if not the largest proportion, of people with mental retardation. And it is 100% preventable. So that really says why it's so important for women to understand. But in many circumstances, you may not know you're pregnant. And depending on the amount that you drink, and there are a lot of social characteristics associated with that. The other part about it, there is some societies or culture where women drink silently or is not as obvious. It's not a, quote, equal access gender society part-time. Now, there are other cultures where, you know, women are known and it's socially acceptable to drink. So it's a very key part of these programs to get the information out there, not only with women, but now we're moving it even back further into the school systems. When you're looking at hygiene and health, it just becomes part of the message. And new research is saying that maybe there is some elements that are affecting males who drink too. This is a very new area of looking at the impact of on men. Unfortunately, the initial approach to prevention was blaming and shaming. You know, you've been a bad girl, you've been drinking, and now you have this baby with FASD. I think the understanding now, particularly with the social determinants of health, saying it's much more complex. But there's no doubt that exposure to alcohol in utero affects the fetus. Having said that, there are some women who drink who don't produce babies with FASD. So that is a message that says we still have so much to learn about what the biochemistry is, what the impact in utero is, and there's quite a lot of bench research going on in this area.
So it's really something of a crapshoot at this point.
I think that's a good way of saying it. This is more anecdotal because I can't pull the references up right now. But when I say the social determinants of health, a woman who is healthy, who has good nutritional balance, who has a better social setting and support, has got the dice loaded in her favor. That if she does have one glass of wine or two, and then discovers she's pregnant and stops, there may not be any actual residual or permanent damage. But a woman who comes from a lower socioeconomic class, who is highly disadvantaged, who is poor, has nutritional deficits, whose health to begin with is marginal, and maybe in a social relationship where her partner is drinking, she's very hard-pressed not to participate in those activities. We've gone beyond blaming and shaming to say we have to take a much broader and informed view.
And how early can FASD be diagnosed in children?
Well, the diagnostic process at this stage is not a nice little biological test. It is a very complex process, and simply said, when a baby's born, if there is some indication of the mother has a history of drinking, and we're not very good at that, I say this to any physicians that are listening or people in the area of obstetrics, that we have to do a better job in our basic intake processes and histories of just asking the question, when was the last time you had a drink? And that will give you insight if this is someone who does drink or not. And then if you have that cue, you are then going to monitor this baby when born, because there are some classical facial features that babies who are very severely affected will show. And they have to do with the space between the eyes. It has to do with that little ridge above your mouth, that little piece above that's very flat. Also, you see a very thin lip. The upper lip is very thin. And there are some others, but those are the classical things. But in my research, as it is now coming out with adults, we're not sure if some people who have FAS don't demonstrate those characteristics, or with age and over time that they disappear. Because in my group of 49, we only had three who showed those classical features. The rest of the group, and 90% of them did pass the diagnosis for an FAS, had no facial features at all. So we don't know if it disappears or it wasn't there in the beginning. So the other part that is absolutely critical before you can make any of the spectrum disorder diagnosis, you must confirm that the mother was drinking during the pregnancy. And usually that means an interview with the mother or tracking the birth mother, which can be very, very difficult, or going with a very reliable surrogate who will confirm that the mother was drinking during that period of time. Another way to do it is if there are any health records available, maybe there were blood tests during the pregnancy or someone else did a history. But in order to absolutely make the diagnosis of an FASD disorder, you must confirm maternal drinking.
And once so, that's happened, what's the next step in determining the diagnosis?
Well, you measure the face with the children. There's two procedures. The one most highly developed one is in child assessment, and there is an American model diagnostics, and Canada has turned out a diagnostic profile, but they're both very similar. And you do a series of measurements on the face, and you recognize these features if they're present and document them. Then the second element is growth. It is usually confirmed that there is some abnormality in growth, and you will see that either babies are considerably smaller, or they might have physical characteristics like small heads. We call that microcephalic heads. And so you have, that's the second measure. The third measure comes from testing. And so they have to be able to respond to some neuropsychological tests. And there you have to have an objective measure of brain functioning. And you have to have a certain degree of impairment. So you have the facial features, you have the growth, you have brain functioning, and the fourth element is the confirmation of the mother drinking. And it's expensive. It takes a multidisciplinary team, and the assessments, at least here, can run anywhere from $4,000 to $6,000.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it is a multi-step process, clearly.
Yes, and every time, you know, we get some more definitive research, and I must say that some of the work now on brain plasticity and functional neuromagnetic resonance, it is showing us some of the other aspects that it's not just the structure of the brain affected, which we can see on some other forms, but it may very well be some of the brain chemistry or the circuitry. So the connections between the electrical impulses in the brain are also affected. So not just a permanent impairment through structure, a smaller part of the brain, or an underdeveloped part of the brain. As you can imagine, this happens at a cellular level.
Yes, and we'll get to that. I've got Professor Sharon Britnell on the phone today, the president of the World Federation of Occupational Therapists. We're talking about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. Coming up, we find out what an occupational therapist does in the management and treatment of this condition, as well as more on the effects of this disorder on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. This is The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. I have with me today Professor Sharon Brintnell, President of the World Federation of Occupational Therapists. She's speaking to us on the phone all the way from Alberta, Canada. And we're talking about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. So Professor Brintnell, we've talked about how you diagnose this condition and the research that you've done. But as an occupational therapist, what role do you play in managing and studying this?
Well, just for your listeners who may not have caught the first part, this is a brain impairment. And as a result, there are areas of the brain that are affected. The interesting thing with this disorder, the major area affected is executive functioning, the planning, the organizing, the judgment elements, control of impulsivity. And as a result of that, this affects people's ability to do the requirements that society requires them. That means to look after themselves, to get a job. In fact, I was just testing some clients yesterday. And an example is you get a young man who seems to have had a lot of jobs in the last 6 years, has no difficulty getting jobs. When he does the job, he does it well, but he always loses the job. He either gets fired for a number of reasons, and this is the kind of thing you see. Some of the individuals can have normal IQs, so we have a lot of expectations for them. Also, people with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders have great verbal facility, so they present themselves in the best light. They are wonderful conversant, and they're charming, but they lack the performance abilities. They can't sequence things. They can't plan a task in order to complete it. And all of those things relate to what occupational therapists work with. Now, I must say that this particular disorder is a multidisciplinary team. So you have teachers working with young children in school who may also be being treated for attention deficit disorders, and that's one of the distinguishing things you want to be sure of. What are we dealing with, an attention deficit disorder, or is it fetal alcohol? And so in that area, you're dealing a lot with what we might call the component skills. OTs are looking at perceptual motor, the ability to see things and to put them into the right spatial arrangements, to be able to hold a pencil. Children also demonstrate a very high sensitivity to the environment, to variety of sounds, touch, and so working with them to be more responsive and to be able to do the normal play things that a child does. As you get older, the needs change a bit. And, of course, when you become more autonomous in your teens, unfortunately, a secondary effect is that you get a lot of substance abuse with this particular group because they are impulsive. They get involved with the wrong group of people, their social networks, and they then get a secondary kind of brain impairment. There's literature that says that adolescents who start drinking at a young age, 12 or 13, do impair their brain functioning. So a young person with FAS has one impairment. They start drinking or taking drugs in adolescence. There's a secondary, or another primary, not a secondary, another primary there. So in that area, you're trying to deal with teaching them some controls about their emotions, habit training. So every day you have a routine. You get up in the morning, you do certain things. You then complete those and you get ready to school. This population really responds much better to visual cues and signs and colored things rather than a lot of words and printed things. So OTs therefore help parents, and often it's foster parents, in planning activities, or as we have in our homes here, you hang up your coat. Instead of saying hang your coat up here, you'd have the coat hanger and you'd show a picture of the coat. So there's visual cues on behaviors, and then the consistency. With adults, it is frequently trying to develop some of their basic skills for the workplace, so that they are punctual, that they show up on time. But if they have had an early childhood experience where they've not had good habits, it's very, very challenging. So the group I work with is the adults. I deal with the adults who are underserved and frequently have never been diagnosed. So they have maybe 20 years, 30 years of being considered antisocial or maybe attention deficit without anybody recognizing they have a brain impairment. So in those cases, you're using environmental cues. You're maybe working with group homes and other people who are providing what we sometimes call an external brain, which is the organizer and the prompter of what has to be done.
So
that's a broad view of what OTs can offer.
Okay. And what I want to know with regards to building these habits and so on is, you know, as you point out, one of the things that that people within this disorder would lack are, for instance, you know, planning abilities, and, you know, all the other things that for some people come completely naturally to them. So mm-hmm. when you build these habits into their lives, or when you give them these behavioral cues, how much of it sticks, or how much of it can you really develop on a long-term basis, since these abilities or capabilities tend to change according to the situation, right? So for most of us who have good planning abilities, you adapt those abilities to different situations as and when they arise. But with people within this disorder, how do you kind of help them build that?
You know, that is the question that we are struggling with, because every one of these people, I mean, we're all unique and we know that, but when you have FASD, unlike some of the other things like Parkinson's or multiple sclerosis, where you have an idea of where the pathology is and where the change is, with this disorder, you don't know exactly what sections. You can say the executive function, but we know the limbic system, where emotions are controlled, down in the amygdala and the hypothalamus, that area is affected, and that's, you know, very primitive area where we get the impulsivity and we get difficulties with working memory. They can't retain these things, and the challenge for adults is at times overwhelming, because they're free agents. If they're not in jail and you don't have a fence around them, which you don't with an adult, with a child, they live in the home, they've got a caregiver, they're in school, there are some environmental controls. With an adult, you don't. So what you do have to do is work on getting a commitment from the individual and building a relationship with them so that they see you as a support. And often they are connected with the people who raise them, and frequently it's not their birth parents, it's their foster parents or adopted parents. And in those circumstances, you look to residential supports. Right now, I mean, we're spending a lot of time saying, I think we need a long-term residential setting where individuals who are diagnosed with FASD can be out of the mainstream, away from the stimulus, away from the prompts, and have an opportunity to practice. They sometimes do better in the military because there isn't a structure in an organization. If I'm thinking about a virtual confinement to them.
But that's quite frightening.
That's the problem.
Yeah, because of the impulsivity, right? It's kind of worrying that they would do well in the military.
Well, you know, for those who are not as affected, they can adapt to and get into the habit training, and they get into the regimentation. For those who make it in but are more severely impaired, they don't last very long. they don't get up in the morning because they just decided they're going to sleep in. And they don't respond to the regimentation because it in a sense, they act out against it. They hear the message, but they don't take it in and say, that's something I shouldn't do.
Before we move on to other aspects of the disability, what is going on chemically, you know, within the womb that could cause changes on a molecular level? Because as you were saying earlier, it's a cellular issue.
It, you know, alcohol is known to be iatrogenic. It's a deadly substance, and it has that effect on the cells. I don't know at this point if we would say it destroys cells, it modifies cells. There's a lot of research into the element. Of course, you know, that's very difficult because you can only do some of that on autopsy or through chemical. And of course, there's a lot of animal model research going on yet. Who are looking at the actual changes in the brain itself. And so you see smaller brains, you see greater spaces, you see the corpus callosum that connects the two lobes, abnormalities there. So it's sometimes a matter of not affecting some of the proteins in the brain. We're really, you know, this is an amazing area and an amazing challenge to narrow it. Everything's affected because they end up with physical disabilities, they end up with sensory disabilities, they end up with cognitive disabilities, they end up with affective disabilities. Nothing is spared.
And it goes along a whole range.
Yes.
Right.
I'm just looking at something that says the clinical manifestations may include also cardiac abnormalities, urogenic defects, skeletal abnormalities, visual and hearing problems, and many others. So those are the things that we see and react to. The other things we've been talking about are, you know, are buried in the brain itself.
A recurring theme when I was doing reading on the subject is that exact numbers of people affected are difficult to define. Now, you mentioned how complex the diagnostic process is. Is that one of the reasons, or, you know, are there other contributing factors?
Well, I think there's a couple of contributing factors. We've been doing some research in Canada. First of all, you have to admit you've got the problem and then start to look for it. In Canada, there are numbers, and there seems to be a higher, and the numbers quoted are higher in our Aboriginal populations. They say 1 to 2% per 1,000 live births in the regular mainstream, but either around 190 per 1,000 live births in Aboriginal communities. And that's because there's an association of poverty, disadvantaged, and high alcohol rates. But we're looking at that population with far more detail than we are, say, looking at white Anglo-Saxons. And that was my point about obstetricians taking better histories. We know some societies that have higher rates of drinking. It seemed to me, I looked at Malaysia's health statistics just before I was with you last May, and alcohol consumption in women is very, very, very low. That's in the recorded area. And as I say, as we become a global world with exposure to all kinds of publicities and marketing and everything going on, those rates are changing. So that makes the prevalence rates very difficult because people are not measuring them, or they're denying that they even have the problem, much like it was with HIV many, many years ago. We don't have the problem, so we don't have any.
Are there any studies right now that are following the course of this condition in a child, you know, from the point where they're first diagnosed to... yes, that's right.
Well, there is one going backwards right now. One of our colleagues here are retesting adults who had been tested and confirmed with a diagnosis as a child. This is a large rehabilitation facility. And so they're now going back and trying to look at the test results, because that's, as I said, there's quite a battery of tests and measurements. And looking now at the adult, do they have the same facial features? Have they gone into a different percentile in terms of their height and weight and their growth? And is their brain functioning more severe, less severe, or what? So they are looking at it, but in a retrospective way. There are beginning to do some work, I think, in the University of Washington in Seattle, has been a leader in research in fetal alcohol spectrum disordered for quite some time. And they have a number of programs, and I believe one of their study areas is this longitudinal element. There hasn't been as much money put in. You know, researchers tend to follow money. You need the money to do these studies. And if there isn't any funding for fetal alcohol, you're not going to see it. But given now the recognition and some work on the costs of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, it's now showing itself to be a growing burden in society. In Canada right now, they say the annual long-term economic cost is about 130 to 400 million each year in Alberta alone. So you begin to multiply those numbers across the country and other places. This is a very significant burden on health and social system. So that's why all the money is being spent into prevention campaigns and awareness building. But we still have to deal with the people who are walking around.
And for those people, you know, how does this condition really affect their lives? And more importantly, I guess, how does the diagnosis affect their lives? Because, you know, you go around thinking that this is just how you are, and then you find out that perhaps, you know, there's something that caused it.
Well, in some cases, it's a relief. There's an annual conference, if anyone's very interested, in the University of British Columbia, usually in the spring, on fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. One year it's an international one, one is a local one. And in the last 3 years, we've had some wonderful, inspiring young people who have been diagnosed with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, speaking about their life and their experience, and living with a hidden disorder. And one young woman from the United States who academically is excellent, and I think she said she had about a 3.8 average, who even won a beauty contest, but she is alcohol exposed, and she knows in some categories where she has some challenges to meet. So you've got this broad spectrum of impact, and the living with the experience is harder for those at the lower end who have low IQs, who have higher severities in terms of what we call behavior modulation, who are probably substance abusers, and some of them who also have psychiatric disorders. In our group, we had 63% of the people we had also had psychiatric disorders. So that's adding some evidence to the fact maybe they're primary disorders, not secondary to the FAS. They didn't develop the psychiatric as a result of the FAS. So this is why you see this disorder is so complex. And those are the people that tend to be the high recidivists.
Right. And does it also reflect in physical health, not just psychiatric health?
Oh, yes. They have multiple physical disorders because of the bad judgment, just making it very simple. They don't see health care providers. Many are homeless at that level of impairment. So their nutritional part there, and if they get into drugs and crystal meth, they have needs for dental work. If they, most of the drugs they're taking are often crystal meth, and some are crack cocaine. There are not as many are hard heroin users, so you, but you do, for some that might be needle sharing, you're going to get hep C, and you'll get just this debilitated general body.
You're right. And a lot of it stemming from bad judgment, which can't be helped in this instance.
Yes, in that, but they're also, in a sense, we're beginning to look at some of the epigenetics in here in terms of, you know, was there a history of alcohol use and abuse in the parents? Was there greater risk factors with this particular group who show up more impaired? The court system is now beginning to recognize that this particular profile does not belong in jail. We need to do some of what we call diversional courts that have been in place for mental health offenders. They need treatment. With FAS, you cannot cure it. All you're doing is managing it. The brain impairment is permanent. So this is where the environment and the environmental supports. And as you pointed out, you need to deal with the environment in a way that is long-term. And this is where I mentioned, I think, that residential, at least a year to two types of treatment centers that deal with the alcohol or the substance abuse, deal with behavior. It's almost a habilitation model rather than a rehabilitation model. They have to learn these routines. And they have to rehearse them and rehearse them and rehearse them.
My final question to you, Professor Britnell, would be, you know, how preventable is this condition and what do we need to be doing to create more awareness?
100% preventable. To educate young women, primarily, because, you know, we are the ones who carry the child, that if you're even thinking about getting pregnant, then, you know, it's about being healthy. And being healthy is good nutrition, the foods, good sleep, and not taking any drugs or alcohol. So that's the first thing, that it gets rolled into our general education for women who are contemplating pregnancy. For teenagers who might be engaging in sexual practices early, then it is very much a need to use prophylaxis and to be aware of that. But also to educate young men, this is not just a woman's problem. This is men who need to take some responsibility. We've had a lot of cases lately. I don't know about the news in Malaysia again, but around the world where women have been sexually assaulted while they've been inebriated. Men have to take responsibility for their actions, too. So it's a community approach that has to be there. And we have to look after our young people and give them other alternatives to lifestyles that are absolutely detrimental. And it's often young pregnancies, young women, who are giving birth to FAS.
Thank you, Professor Britnell.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure again.
I've been speaking to Professor Sharon Britnell, President of the World Federation of Occupational Therapists, about her work in the area of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.